Yeah, there's something there, but I looked up the 1.5. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's made up, but it's interesting.
It's made up. I know people who have
it. I don't mean it's fake, but they don't. What happens is adults are manifesting diabetes, which seems to have traits of type 1 diabetes, as opposed to the type 2, which has certain associations that you don't see in terms of causes and things like that, some of the physical aspects. And the problem is type 1 diabetes classically has been understood to be something people develop when they're much younger, not when they're in their 30s.
That's different.
Well, that's sort of the key starting point. And then the late onset diabetes is thought to be, it's the autoimmune system attacking the pancreas, which is like type 1. And it means they may be able to last longer without needing insulin, based on what I was reading. I mean, all this is Mayo Clinic stuff, so I'm sure it's dumbed down for the popular reader as opposed to like the real science of it. But on the other hand, it's the Mayo Clinic, and they know what they're talking about. So I assume what they dumbed down correctly. So, yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. I never knew the background.
Yep. Okay. Latent autoimmune diabetes in adults is the official name.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. In any case, we talked about testing blood. We talked about delivering insulin. No, it's a new sheet. I did upload it. I know I uploaded it. Medical treatment on Shabbos number 24, which for the record means we have like 3 classes left, I think. Yeah, and then review.
I don't have it.
It's there.
No, I bet it's there, but for some reason...
Okay, so just somebody send it out on the secret group chat, and then we can keep on learning. Okay. So we're up to assembling a disposable needle on Shabbos, which, again, with modern devices for delivering insulin, you know, this may not be relevant for people. However, it's something that people definitely need to know about in terms of overall... using needles and injecting on Shabbos, it comes up in a lot of other ways. So it's best if one gets a pre-assembled needle, then you don't have any of these headaches that we're going to describe. What would be the concern theoretically in taking pieces and putting together a functional needle on Shabbos? Ayelet?
Bona and makabepatish.
Yeah, bona and or makabepatish. The two get brought in on this kind of hand in hand, and you'll see the post can like quote both of them without saying which one it is. But fundamentally, you're taking these two unusable parts, you are attaching them together to make a functional whole. So yes, either bone, because you are putting them together, they now lock into place, or makabepatish, because you're taking things that were not functional and you're making them functional. So what can you do to avoid this problem? Yeah, Rebecca. So yeah, if you can do it pre-assembled, that's fine. The reason why you don't generally do it pre-assembled is because?
Cleanliness,
right? You want it to be protected, as well as danger, right? It's a needle. Right, there are issues of needing refrigeration. Like, it depends on what we're talking about. We're talking about insulin, we're talking about other uses. But yeah, if it has to be preloaded and it has to be refrigerated, like there are problems. But yes, if you can get preloaded, pre-assembled, and everything else, that would certainly be a better option. Ayala.
Get a non-Jew to do it for you.
Right. So getting a non-Jew to do things for you, as a general rule, does mitigate your malacha problems. One suggestion that's brought for this that's different from what we've been talking about until now is break the needle afterwards.
That's dangerous. Also.
You assemble it. No, it's not. You'll say a second. You assemble it, and then you use it, and then you break it. That's actually what they recommend anyway for people who use a needle, having nothing to do with halacha, having nothing to do with Shabbos, to prevent people from reusing a needle, which is... not sterile. Yeah.
What about you don't see these red buckets that people who have to use injections put stuff into? Does that count as like breaking it because it's just going to be disposed?
Right. So no, but I think what they often have is like a thing you put the needle in and then you bend it so it breaks. I think they do that. Yeah.
I'm just a little bit confused. You're saying that you would
prepare it before Shabbos.
No, if you prepare it before Shabbos, none of this is a conversation. You're so fine.
This is on Shabbos.
You assembled it.
The needle, you use it, and then you break the needle.
And then you break it, and that way your assembly was temporary.
Oh, okay.
That's the idea. Yeah.
If you don't have that, if you don't have that thing to bend it, yeah, playing with a needle is a bad idea.
Yes, that is true. However, I think these are designed to actually be broken easily for this purpose, in order to prevent reuse. Like, reusing needles is a known scourge. It's a terrible thing that people, unfortunately, usually in the world of drugs, end up doing. And it causes serious spread of disease. Yeah. Yes?
Making something temporary fixes the golden issue, but does it fix the macrophagic issue?
So that's the suggestion, is that it would, but this is what we have to talk through. The Chasam Sofer, in his tshuva in Or HaChaim Ayin Beis, where he's talking about putting together umbrellas on Shabbos, as part of his conversation, says that temporary construction is not called construction on a deoraisa level. The numerous sources agree that it is in fact a derabanan. The Chazon Ish says that it's a derabanan. However, there are others who disagree based on a couple of Gemaras, for example. I brought you two of them, actually. Take a look on your sheet at source number one. It's a Gemara in Shabbos regarding a particular type of bed. It was a folding bed. So, Bei Rav Chama have a Mita Glal Nisa. They had this Mita Glal Nisa. It's a folding bed. That's what we're talking about. In the house of Rav Chama. Have a Mahadri La B'Yom Atava. So on Yom Tov, they would actually assemble the bed. Amar le'ahu midrabanan l'Rava. So one of the Chachamim said to Rava, "My daitach, what exactly do you think here when you say this is permitted? Why should it be permitted? Binyan min hatzadhu. Do you view it as binyan min hatzad? Binyan min hatzad does not mean construction from the side, the literal translation of the words. It means that it is unusual construction. Like we say regarding muktzah, tiltul min hatzad. Is this permitted because it is temporary construction? De'eino takua, I added in brackets. It's unusual construction because this is not firmly in place. Nehi de isura de araisa leka isura de rabbanan miha ika. Even if there's no biblical prohibition, there still is a rabbinic prohibition. So Amar Lei, he replied, Anan Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel severely. He says, no, I follow the view of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Da'amarim haya rafui mutter. He said it's entirely permitted if it is loose. So the position that Rava articulates, and Rashi explains it here, is that the folding bed, and I don't know the mechanics of the bed that they're talking about here, but this folding bed, you could attach it loosely and still use it. Nothing here is attached in a firm, permanent way. Therefore, it's entirely permitted. However, if I were to attach it with force, if I were to jam things together, that would actually constitute a de'oraisa. That's one of the sources that's brought to argue that even if you're doing it for a temporary purpose, it's still a problem if you jam it together with force, if you put it together in a way that that it could last. Waiting for the typing to be complete so I can ask if that was clear. Rebecca.
What do you do about a situation where someone has one of those beds that comes down?
The Murphy beds.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the problem? What do you assemble?
Well, because when you put it down, you have to sometimes take the legs out because you want the legs to stick out from the wall. So if
right.
you put it down, the legs come down.
Right.
So is that considered?
Right. So that's okay. Because there you're not actually assembling pieces. All you're doing is unfolding the legs. In the same way that if you have a chair, a folding chair, you're allowed to set up a folding chair on Shabbos. The folding table, assuming that it doesn't have walls, you can assemble that on Shabbos as well. If it has walls that drop down, then you may have an issue of ohel, but that's a separate discussion. So this Gemara teaches me that in the event that I put pieces together with force, that makes it a de'oraisa, and that's an argument then against being able to say that assembling the needle on Shabbos would be fine just because I intend it to be temporary. You have a second example in source number 2, also a Gemara in Shabbos, regarding a barrel. You want wine to flow from a barrel. So I think a couple of weeks ago we talked about stopping up the hole in the barrel and a concern for shechita. Now you're trying to actually get liquid to flow from a barrel. So hai tarfa da'asa. A tarfa da'asa is a myrtle leaf. Tarfa is a leaf. Asa, aleph, samach, aleph is the Aramaic word for hadasim. Anybody know another word that asa is associated with? Aleph, samach, aleph? Can be. There was a king Asa, and that's associated with the meaning of the word also, although people don't realize it.
Is it like rebel?
Nope. He was a good king until he made a mistake. Yeah. Now, the word Asa, Aleph Samach Aleph, refers to a cure, to medicine. There's a journal of medical halacha and medical ethics in Israel called Asya, borrowed from that as well. So what was King Asa's mistake? He had a problem with his legs, right? At the end of his life, Dibrei Yamim records it. I don't think it's in Malachim, I think it's only Dibrei Yamim. He had a problem with his legs at the end of his life, and he went to doctors instead of going to the Navi. You can go to doctors, but you should also go to the Navi if you have Naviim at your disposal, as he did. Disposal, so to speak. I've often thought he's called King Asa because of what he did. You know, with that, there's some kind of an association there about his going to the doctor. But in any case, myrtle leaves or myrtle branches were used for medicinal purposes, and Asa is the Aramaic word for it, and that has nothing to do with our Gemara. Hai tarfa da Asa, myrtle leaves, Asur. You're not allowed to set it up in the hole in a barrel to use it as a kind of a spigot to control the flow of the wine out of the barrel. My time, what's wrong? So Rav Yemar midifti amar, gezera mishum marzev. The concern is, the word in brackets I added, the concern is that you're going to do something to this leaf in order to set it up so that the wine flows properly from it. You're going to change the leaf in some way. You're going to shape it, you're going to cut it, to make that happen, and that would be mitaking. Rav Ashi Amar Gezera Shema Yikto. Rav Ashi says, no, my problem isn't when it's in the barrel. My problem is earlier. If you tell people they're allowed to set up a leaf as channeling the flow from the wine, what are they going to do when they don't have a leaf? They'll go over to a branch, and they'll pick a leaf, which, if it's coming from a tree, is a definite D'oraisa problem on Shabbos. May benayu, what's the difference between these two explanations, asks the Gemara. Ike benayu, the obvious difference is dekatim umanchi. If I have cut leaves around, there's no fear whatsoever that you're going to make a mistake and take a leaf from a tree, but there is still the concern that you're going to shape the leaf. The point being, for our purposes, this is a temporary thing. Using a leaf, you know, to channel the flow of wine from your barrel is not a long-term solution. It's not like you're going to put the leaf in there and then you're just going to use it as long as there's wine left in the barrel. This is like a one-time deal. And yet, you're willing to tell me that somebody who does so is chayav, is liable for doing that if they shape the hadas. They're liable for doing so. So this is brought as evidence once again that even if it's for temporary use, it still could be a deoraisa. So applying this now to our needle, even if you put the pieces together saying, I'm only going to use them now, and then I'm going to break it, that's not going to solve my problem. Are we clear? Yes? No? There are a lot of people who are typing an awful lot, and I just want to make sure that we're still on. Good?
So it's just that they can't pick leaves because either on the like fold them or do something to them in a certain way that's not allowed.
So you're not allowed to pick leaves on Shabbos. We're saying don't use the leaves that you have as a spigot, either lest you shape the leaf, mm-hmm. or lest you pick a leaf off of a tree. And our point in bringing the source is just because you're talking about concern lest they shape the leaf, even though it's a temporary use. That shows that fixing something like that, even though it's for a temporary use, is still a de'oraisa. Yeah, Natalie. Correct. Correct. Both the first source, which talked about assembling the bed, and the second source, which talks about shaping the leaf, are brought to show that temporary construction or temporary makeh bepatish is still called a de'oraisa. That's the argument. But there are two mitigating factors here. And the Tzitz Eliezer brings the first of those factors. He says, it's true that even if it's for temporary use, you can call it a de'oraisa potentially. However, this is really only for immediate use one time, and then you're going to disassemble it right away. Take a look at source number 3. Yesh gam l'chalek, he says, there is room to distinguish bein tikun beguf hadavar kafi shem hadugmaos shehivi lebein harkavaz manit dugmat harkavat machat bimizrak. He says there's a difference between the examples that you brought, in which you're actually fixing something and joining the needle and the syringe, where it's really going to be disassembled right away. How does he know that? So he brings proof from a few sources. One of them is source number 4 from the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav was written by? The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, right? Correct, the author of the Tanya. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav is an important halachic work, even if you are not a Lubavitcher. It still comes up in halachic discussion. And the Tzitz Eliezer brings it in our discussion here, talking about assembling a kli, assembling a tool, out of different components. So take a look at number 4. Vafilu bekli shel prakim. You're talking about assembling a kli, a tool, an implement, out of different parts. Dahainu, meaning shahadkam bechozek. You attach them with strength. It takes work to assemble them. Be'inyan shetzarech lezek gevura ve'umnus, requiring strength and expertise. Darei zeh binyan gamur. That is full-blown construction. When you take pieces and you use know-how and you use strength to jam them together so that they'll stick together, that's binyan. V'chayev mishum boneh. That carries biblical liability for construction. Im asui lehiskayem harbe. If it is made to last for a long time. Vim eino asui lehiskayem harbe. However, if it's not made to last for a long time, hareze binyan arai va'asur midivrei sofrim. That takes it down to being a derabanan. And then he says, elim kein eino asui lehiskayem klal, unless it is not meant to last at all. So the Tzitz Eliezer says, look how he's defining the categories. He is distinguishing between where it's done permanently, where it's done temporarily, and where it's done to be disassembled right away. The needle's going to be disassembled right away. Therefore, it'll take it down to being a permitted action. So argues the Tzitz Eliezer from, among other things, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. He also quotes the Chazon Ish, who points out that we may distinguish between construction when you're talking about building a house, a shelter, something like that, and constructing a kli, a tool. He says building a kli for temporary use is itself a derabanan. He says because you're talking about building a kli as opposed to building a house. That's an interesting distinction in its own right.
But if it's a house,
sorry?
But if it's a house,
then it sounds like you would leave it as a de'oraisa. You have to go back and look at the Chazon Ish. That's the Chazon Ish.
Is that on the source sheet?
No. But he still wrote it. If anyone wants to look it up, it's in Moed Nun Aleph Yud Zayin. Starts with the word Aval. What do you mean? In which case?
A kli versus a house?
No. That's not the core difference between kalim and houses. The core difference between kalim and houses is that intuitively, boneh refers to building a house. And then the question is, when we apply it to Kalim, does it have all the rules that it has when it comes to building a house? And that's what the Chazon Ish is saying is different. That for Binyan B'Kalim, temporary construction will knock it down to a Dirabanan, not necessarily when you're talking about a house. So this is all one mitigating factor, the immediate disassembly. The other factor that may permit it is brought by the Echav Adas, Rav Avadia Yosef, in source number 5. And just as the Shulchan Aruch Harav is important even if you are not Lubavitch, Rav Avadia Yosef is important even if you are not Sephardi. Yes?
Am I wrong, but I feel like...
Should I just say yes?
If you're building it to use it, that's not destruction right away. You're using it. Destruction,
yes, but you're using it momentarily. The sense is, what you're asking is a good question. It goes back to a discussion from the first semester that I mentioned it last time also. I don't remember how it came up. The discussion was tying a knot. If you tie a knot and you only need it in place for a limited time, but for that time it's going to be functional, there is a very strong view to say that's called a permanent knot because it lasts as long as you need it to last. If so, you're arguing the same thing should be true over here. You only need it once. You built it for that. That's, therefore, it's functional. Therefore, it's considered, so to speak, permanent in that sense. But I think there is a distinction to be made between knots and construction, because when you think of construction, you think of something durable. Knots, not necessarily.
Even now.
I mean, they're the ones who were quoting on the knots.
Right. No?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Knots were used more often to tie up the animal, you know, while you went into the building, or, you know, sailors use knots in a more serious way. Like, we have distinctions between kinds of knots. But yeah. Yeah.
I'm just a little tempted to pull back. I forgot why we said that braiding is bona. If it's not temporary, then why would it...
Right, so braiding seems to be bona because the Gemara says it's bona.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The discussion of what if it's temporary or not, when we had the discussion in class afterwards, I went looking to see, you know, anybody who discusses the case of braiding where you intend to undo it, and I did not see leniencies, which is why I didn't bring it back into the class. Sorry. Now I did. Okay. So the point that Rav Avadia makes is the type of assembling that you're doing. Take a look at number 5. He says, Kan, in our case here, he's talking about assembling a needle. Shetchivas hamachat b'mizrak ein bad suarech lemaise uman. He says, putting the needle into the syringe, right, which is what you're doing here, right? Did anyone know the basic parts of a needle, right? You have the plunger part, and then you have the pointy part, right? So they're talking about putting those together. So putting the needle into the plunger, ein bad suarech lemaise uman. That doesn't require any sort of expert craftsman's work. Ein ba iser Torah klal. There is no biblical prohibition in doing so. The Ode and further, Sharei kan hanoeg hu lahashlich hamachat miyad lachar hazrika. The practice here is that we throw out the needle right after doing the injection. Ulitzorch zrika acheres mishtamshim b'machat acheres. He says, when you need to do another injection, you take a new needle. Havi binyan l'shah. It is temporary construction. Vinoda Shadas Achasim Sofer Shabinyan Lasha Lo Havi Binyan. He quotes the Chasim Sofer. Temporary construction does not constitute construction. The Odin further. Shafiu Divrei Ha'or Sameach Shehel La Shahalacha Kedivrei Rishalmi Shabinyan Lasha Havi Binyan. Even within the view of the Or Sameach. The Or Sameach was? Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. Yeah. That's it. The Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. So even within the view of the Or Sameach, who in fact says that we follow the Yerushalmi, who says that temporary construction is construction, unlike what the Chasam Sofer said. Mikomakom nira shehem heim yodu. He says, still, they themselves will admit, shebenidon shalanu ein baze iser Torah klal. There is no biblical prohibition in the case of the needle. Lefi ma shepasa b'shulchan aruch hagon Rabbi Zalman. He quotes to the Shulchan Aruch Harav that we saw in source number 4. He says, even temporary construction is only called construction if it's going to last that day. But in a case like ours, where it's being disassembled right away, then they will agree as well. So he really is making two points, right? He's making the point about Uman, the craftsman, and he's making the point about the immediate disassembly. That's the position of the Chavedas. So we're lenient because you're going to break the needle right away. So in the event that you're able to get a pre-assembled needle, that's awesome. However, if you can't get a pre-assembled needle, we have a leniency because you are going to break it right away to say, bless you, this is not called construction. That's the idea. And so brings source number 6, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, where he says one should strive to use. You see that? Yishtadel yishtamish b'mizrok shekvar mechuberes elav mibaod yom machat matima. You should try to use a needle that already has, a syringe I should say, that already has the needle joined to it from before Shabbos. Ach im ein kazeh, but if that's not available, then mutar gam lechaber mizrok lemachat matima. You would be allowed to join it on Shabbos. I saw hands. Natalie, and then Rebecca. So the first point that he's making is that there's no great expertise involved in assembling it, and therefore that weakens its status as bona. And then the second one is that even those who say that where it's temporary, it's still a malacha, or it's at least a derabanan, they will not say that if you're talking about immediate disassembly. They would require it to last for a day in order for it to really be anything significant. Rebecca, what was your question?
I was just going to say, I know the answer.
Okay, you are correct. Yes, so to answer the question that Rebecca answered, we've said from the beginning, the diabetic is considered cholesh yesh bo sakana, and therefore, if you need it, you just do it.
Right.
But where you have options, you take the better options. I had somebody reach out to me yesterday with a Pesach question about somebody with type 1 diabetes needing to take glucose tablets. Right? Glucose tablets, for those who are not familiar, is sugar. Hard sugar. And it's done for somebody who needs sugar now. Like they can't wait for their body to digest food that they're going to eat. And their question was, glucose tablets may have chametz origins. They don't necessarily, but they may have chametz origins. And therefore, what do you do about it for Pesach? So my answer to this person was, obviously do your research before Pesach and see if you can get glucose tablets or a substitute for them. But in the event that this person needs a glucose tablet, that's not the time to start messing around. Someone who needs a glucose tablet needs it now. So don't say, well, I'm going to give them a raisin as a substitute. That is a terrible idea. When you need immediate sugar, you need immediate sugar. So the same thing is true in this discussion. If they need insulin injected into them and what's available is a needle that you need to assemble with strength, with whatever, and it's going to do it doesn't make a difference. You're using whatever you need. Yeah, Daniela. Right, so if you can assemble it safely. If pre-assembled needles exist.
Right, but I'm saying if you have the separate things.
Yes, and you're able to do it in a way that keeps it safe in terms of both people misusing it or stabbing themselves and in terms of keeping it antiseptic. So great. If that's an option, sure. Mm-hmm. What is definitely not a good option is a reusable needle. A reusable needle, meaning like a permanent one that you sterilize in between uses. Why is that a bad idea? Yeah.
Then you're not going to break it?
No. Nope. You don't assemble it. It's already assembled.
You'd have to rip open packages to clean it, like to get some sort of cleaner for it.
Right, so you don't even clean it that way. The way that they clean a reusable needle is with an autoclave, like it gets heated. Yeah. Right, so I don't think they use alcohol swabs for reusable needles. I think they actually cook it. Why are you making a face?
That sounds really nasty because I use injections for something and I was just so used to the alcohol swab and just all of that and the fact that you have to reheat it
Right, so I think that's what they do. I think they use an autoclave for it. I could be wrong, but that's my understanding.
I don't think it's a machine, so
it is a machine.
That would be the issue.
also
yes, and it's also mabasha.
That is yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You boil up water. I mean, that's what, okay. Yeah. Okay. So that concludes the insulin injection discussion, which leads to a third piece of this, which is lighter in terms of it's not terribly complicated, but it's really important. First of all, what the topic is concerns related to Shabbos meals for somebody who is a diabetic. We spend so much time talking about malacha, but how does one fulfill the mitzvos of Shabbos, having three meals, having kiddush, when they're worried about the fact that they are diabetic and therefore there are serious restrictions on their safe eating, and they could eat more, but eating more is going to necessitate testing for blood sugar, which is going to necessitate doing the things that we talked about before. And potentially it's going to need insulin afterwards. So what do you do? So first of all, I mentioned this last time, and I quoted it. If you remember the piece about Soveya with the testing for ketones, right? That came from their publication, Friends with Diabetes, this group. But I gave you the website in source number 7. I think it may even still be active, even though it looks like websites that were created in 1995. Nonetheless, the materials are linked on the site. So I don't know if anybody is updating it or isn't it, but it's good. For people who have questions about diabetes, it's a good resource. So first issue that comes up is an issue we've already discussed, sort of, and that is people with diabetes may need to measure food, to weigh it, you know, in order to gauge the impact that it's going to have on them. Would one be allowed to measure the food on Shabbos?
Yeah.
Yes. Why?
It's part of the standard of care.
Easier.
Is it, well, it's full of shah, you're supposed to come up, and weighing, I think, is a diabana.
Also true. But we said last time that when we talked about measuring for insulin, right, we said measuring for medical purposes is allowed. It's not called the measuring that they prohibited in the first place. So, and it's measuring for a mitzvah, because it's for your suit of Shabbos. Even better, it's true. Obviously, it's better if you do this before Shabbos and you know your doses and everything else, but if it's Shabbos, the measuring is fine. It's not an issue. What about making kiddush? So, we said last time that we have concerns when it comes to both wine and grape juice, right? People know here the science of how you make grape juice?
You make it out.
No.
Wine.
How do you make grape juice?
A ton of sugar and...
No, you do not need to introduce any sugar. How do you make wine? Let's start from wine.
You leave out grape juice.
Ferment.
Okay, no. Leaving out grape juice will never make wine. If it does, then they did something wrong. Normally, grapes, okay? Grapes have a lot of sugar in them. Bacteria like to eat the sugar, especially if you introduce bacteria for this purpose, but historically it was done with ambient bacteria also. Bacteria digest the sugar. That is a process known as fermentation, right? Leaving behind alcohol. That goes on until your bacteria reach a particular level in the alcohol level reaches a certain point within the liquid, and at that point it kills the bacteria and fermentation stops. So conventional wisdom, and what I had always heard, is that stops when the alcohol gets to about 14-15%, which is why table wines that you see max out at 14-15%. Somebody just mentioned to me in a shiur on Shabbos that I was giving that they know of a process in which it can actually go higher than that. I'm not familiar. Generally, when you see hard alcohol that's higher than that, that's because they did one of two things. Either they actually added alcohol, or they, sorry? No, because they'll die. Right, they distill it. So either what you're doing is adding alcohol or you're removing other liquids, one or the other, in order to get a higher percentage that's alcohol. But that's how you make wine. And historically, it would be automatic. The only way you would have had grape juice historically is if you had it right after you squeeze the grapes. Once it starts fermenting, you have a problem. There was a type of powder that they used, a white powder. I don't remember anymore what the what mineral it was, but they would use to halt fermentation. But what happens if you halt fermentation and now there is sugar left in this liquid?
Crystals.
Sorry?
Crystals.
Not crystals. You're not distilling it. What's going to happen if you leave sugar in this thing? What happens if you leave grape juice out?
Spoils.
It'll get moldy, right? Stuff's going to grow. And it's not going to be the bacteria that make wine. The stuff is going to grow on this sugar. So grape juice historically was not a thing unless you were having it right after you squeezed it. After a couple of days, it was already going bad. So what did they do? The answer is the 19th century came along. And a fellow by the name of Louis Pasteur came along with the idea of pasteurizing things. And that was when they started to have grape juice available. It was actually, I think it was the Methodists in New Jersey who first started doing this with using the pasteurization method in order to have grape juice that they could use for their communion. I think it was that. I don't know if Methodists do communion. I don't know. It had to do with their service somehow. That I do know. Look it up online. You'll find the whole story. But the bottom line is that the grape juice that you use is pasteurized, which means that it still has the sugar content, right? They halt the fermentation process right away in order to avoid the sugar being converted to alcohol. It now has a lot of sugar in it instead of having alcohol in it. Everyone clear on how this works? I'm taking time on it because this matters if you want to understand what's going on with diabetes. This is your liquid, okay? You're starting out with a lot of sugar. If you allow it to ferment, that sugar is going to be digested, and what you will be left with is the alcohol byproduct of fermentation. That's the way it works. If you halt the process here, then you get grape juice, which has a lot of sugar in it. Grape juice is very high in sugar. If you allow it to instead ferment, you end up with alcohol, not sugar. So when we said that diabetics, on the one hand, will have a problem with sugar, they'll have a problem with grape juice. On the other hand, we said a lot of alcohol is also not good for them, right? Because of the effect on the liver. So what are they supposed to do? You see the problem? There are wines, by the way, that are partially fermented, and then they halt the fermentation process. So you get these wines that are 5.5% or 7% or something like that. They'll have a higher sugar content than a 14% wine, but they will have a lower sugar content than grape juice will. Like, there are in-betweens. Clear? Good? I'm pretending I know chemistry? Okay. So
a person half an hour.
So, well, the question, what do you do for the four cups at the Seder? What do you do for Kiddush on Shabbos?
Like, these are both dangerous things for a person with diabetes.
Yes, so that's where we have the problem. So the easy answer is, here's somebody else's Kiddush. Let somebody else make Kiddush. There is no requirement for you to be drinking from Kiddush. As long as they make Kiddush and they drink the proper shear, you're fine. So unless you are at a diabetics-only meal, right? In which case, you should import somebody who will be the non-diabetic, who will be the designated drinker. Yes? So this is also a problem. What do you do for the Arba Kosos? It's the same problem. The only difference, well, no, I'm not going to call it a difference. The thing to remember about the Arba Kosos is that it's a derabanan. It's an important derabanan, but it's a derabanan. The reason I stopped was I was going to say Kiddush is not, but the truth of the matter is the wine aspect of Kiddush is also a derabanan. We assume that Kiddush Daraisa, you can be Yotze without drinking. So what a diabetic ought to do, first of all, is talk to their doctor and not, you know, listen to me. But the problem that we now have is very clear, right? Grape juice raises the blood sugar. Alcohol is going to inhibit the liver's ability to release glucose into the blood, and therefore it will actually reduce their sugar dangerously, potentially. So if you don't have a designated drinker, there are two other options to consider. Option number one is dilute the wine. So you don't have to have a full cup of wine. If you take a look at source number 8 from the Mishnah Berurah, he's dealing with somebody who is using raisins, putting raisins in water to make something that has some grape juice content to it. He's not dealing with a diabetes issue, but he's talking about adding raisins to water in order to make grape juice, where that's the option you have. So he says, "Sarach li zayr li tain simukim kol kach b'mayim ad shiyu ad simukim ma'at yoser me'echad mishisha neged hamayim." You need to make sure that your grape content is at least 1/6 of the total. And that's a basic principle, that if somebody wants to have a grape drink of some kind and make a bar priagafen, it has to have 1/6 be grape. That's the requirement. So you can dilute your wine to the point where it's 1/6 wine. And that is a good way to mitigate the problem. Watering it down grape juice is not as simple. And the reason why is because when they make grape juice, they tend to do it with water. It isn't all just grape juice. Like with wine, it is all just wine. They can get in trouble if they dilute it. But with grape juice, it actually often is. Often it'll be reconstituted, right? You know about reconstituted juice, right? Hello? I mean, it's not gross. When I was a kid, that was all you drank. Now there's a lot more stuff. But like but basically what you're talking about is, am I a petel in Israel? That's gross.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically it's a concentrate, and then you're supposed to add water to it to dilute it. That's what grape juice sometimes is. It's from concentrate. If you see on the bottle, sometimes not from concentrate, they're trying to tell you this is not gross. That's the idea. So the point is, though, if they reconstituted it from concentrate, that's going to throw off your dilution rates. So the Stark Hayes advice is no more than 50% water. The Stark Hayes gave advice on this about diluting grape juice. So they said no more than 50% water if you're going to dilute grape juice.
So then what's the whole thing? Like, that's just water.
I assume that they watered it down to a rate that is safer, and that is halachically, you know, calculated to make sure you can still make a bar priagafen.
So you're saying it's more than 50. It's the one we have.
I don't know how far they've done it.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
Wait.
You can probably find out on the Kedem website or something. Okay. Yeah.
The Mishnah Berurah and Star K say different amounts.
No, the Mishnah Berurah is talking about watering down wine, and so it's 1/6. Mishnah Berurah is about watering down wine, and the answer is 1/6 wine, 5/6. One sixth wine, 5/6 water is fine. But watering down grape juice is not something the Mishnah Berurah ever addressed. And the issue is a modern issue. It's a question just of making sure you have the proper content. So the Star K says that you should not do more than 50% water, because the grape juice often has water in it already. Yeah, Rebecca. Yeah, anybody can do it. Anybody can do it. One other note about what you have to be careful for, according to Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, who was a major, major posek, lived in Memphis. There were two very famous Rabbi Greenblatts, who lived in Memphis. One was Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, who wrote the Rivavos Ephraim. He wrote away to all of the big gedolim of his time, who were like his peers. He wrote to Rav Moshe Feinstein, he wrote to Rav Gedalia Felder, he wrote to all of the big names, and he wrote this multi-volume set of tshuvos sfarim called Rivavos Ephraim that's incredibly readable. It's a good read. Dealing with very popular and common questions. So this is from his Rivavos Ephraim. The other one was Rav Nata Greenblatt, who traveled all around North America, setting up Eruvin, taking care of Gittin, taking care of Bris Mila. He did all this amazing stuff. Really, both of them very fascinating. They're related to each other. It wasn't random that you had two Rabbi Greenblatts in Memphis at the same time doing cool things. I think uncle and nephew is what I've heard. But anyway, Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, in source number 9, says the following. Nishalti me'echad sha'asa kiddush al hayayin, aval kasha lo lishtos yayin. Somebody made kiddush on wine. Apparently they made kiddush already. I hope they didn't like write away to him with the question at that point, but they made kiddush, and they had a really hard time drinking the wine. They wanted to dilute it to the point where the wine would be very weak. Im yachol, is he allowed to do it? So I said, from a logical perspective, no, you can't do that. You dilute it to the point where you can drink it. You've now lost the title of wine for it. You're not drinking wine. You can mix a little water in. V'sha'alti l'posek, he said, I asked the posek, he doesn't name it. Usually he does. I don't know why he didn't name him here. V'hiskim l'dvari, and he agreed with me. V'ka'es nitpas shut har tzvi. He says, and now, the har tzvi was published. The har tzvi was Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Rav of Yerushalayim, beginning of the 20th century, a very important name to know about in halacha as well. And he wrote, Dahavale k'nishpa chayayin. He said, if you dilute it so much that it doesn't taste like wine anymore, then you didn't drink the wine. It's like somebody who made kiddush and the wine spilled, and they didn't actually drink it. In which case, as I added in brackets in the English, they would actually need to bring a new cup and probably make a new bar priya gafen. Like, you can't do it this way. So what do you do? V'im ken yesh etza sha'acher yishta. So what do you do? Have somebody else drink the wine. Oh, ya'ariv me'at, or bring in, mix in a little. And now is the key line that I wanted to get to. Avala arev harbe, but mixing in a lot, sheyesh bo ta'am mayim, so that it tastes like water, bivadai yefshar, that's no good. In other words, there has to be a wine taste to it. So in addition to what we're saying about percentages, you want to make sure it actually tastes like wine. Clear? That's what you need. Now, taste like doesn't have to mean it's a strong taste, but it can't taste like water either. Generally speaking, at 1/6, it still has, you know, a flavor of wine to it. Wine or grape juice, by the way. It's not one or the other. It has to have that grapeish taste. Rebecca and then Rebecca. No?
No, that's
okay, yeah.
If we're talking from the, like, action that you get in the moment, how would you be allowed to do that? First,
what do you
all,
mean?
Like, are you doing it after the bracha? Because that is what I have saved. I used before that aren't measured.
Right.
Yeah,
so measuring for a mitzvah would be fine. In terms of after the bracha, you're also fine because this is for the sake of being able to drink it. I don't think so. Any more than people who put the salt on their challah after they make hamotzi. I happen to put the salt on the challah before because why not? But there are a lot of people I've seen who put the salt on after. Yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, you could even, person makes hamotzi and then they realize the salt at the other end of the table, you can tell somebody, please pass the salt. Sorry?
That's the whole challah thing. Let's talk about
the challah. The whole challah thing.
That,
I don't know what that means.
All
right, I'm gonna cut you off just because we got to get to the quiz. Sorry. But at some point I'll hear the whole challah thing also. So your solution then, so to speak, no pun intended, is to dilute the wine. Your first idea is simplest. Hear kiddush from somebody else. If you can't do that, have somebody else drink the wine. If you can't do that, then dilute the wine. And that way, it's less of an issue for you. Here's another solution. Combine people drinking to reach the shear. This is not the best approach. This is not an approach that we really, really like. However, it is something that has halachic validity. I brought you the Aruch HaShulchan on it in source number 10. There is a view that, you know, that when you make kiddush, right, you have to drink a certain amount, right? We want to make sure that you drink a certain minimal amount. But it doesn't have to be one person drinking it. The amount you have to drink is a cheekful. The majority of a revius, call it 2 ounces as a round number. But what if you can't drink 2 ounces? So you drink half an ounce, the next person drinks half an ounce, the next person does, and the next person does. And as long as none of you interrupt while that is going on, you are yotze by having multiple drinkers combine. It's not a great view. Not everybody likes this idea, but it does exist. So I mentioned it here. We're not going to read the Aruch HaShulchan inside because I really do want to make sure that we get to the quiz today. Having you wait till Monday is not nice. So that's a solution for the problem. For Hamotzi, by the way, Friends with Diabetes actually recommends whole wheat matzah as opposed to like rich challah. Whole wheat matzah. Their reason being, it has a lower, what's called a lower effective carb count, and it is slower to enter the bloodstream. So that's just an interesting thing to know about. Yes? Sephardi. So the argument would be that if you're using it as your seuda, you're being koveya seuda on it, that even somebody who's Sephardi would still make a hamotzi. In other words, normally. Right. My answer is going to be ask your posek because the Sephardi should be answering this. But my understanding is that Sephardim make a mizonos on matzah because they consider matzah pas haba b'kisnin, right? That's why you're making a mizonos on it. And only on Pesach, when it is a mitzvah to have it as the anchor for your meal, are you going to make a hamotzi on it. But if that's my lechem mishnah, I don't understand why you wouldn't make a hamotzi on it. Granted, I may want to use other things, but I don't understand why that wouldn't be koveya seuda. But then again, I'm not a Sephardi posek, and I don't know the information, so you should ask somebody who does. Last point, and then we're going to do the quiz. Eating shalashuddas on a short Shabbos when somebody is not hungry. Okay, meaning, you have one of these Shabbos is where the sun is setting at like 4:30, and you finish lunch at like 2:00, 2:30, 3:00, and you're not hungry, and the diabetic is potentially endangering themselves by raising their blood sugar by eating more. Certainly, if they're going to eat more at this point, they're going to need to do a blood test, which has its complications. They may need to take insulin. So what are we going to do on their behalf? So there is something called free foods. Free foods means foods that have minimal calories, minimal carbohydrates, and do not necessitate testing if you eat them in limited quantities. And this includes certain fruits, nuts, vegetables, some kinds of dairy. So I asked Rav Schachter the question of whether somebody who is diabetic could rely on the view, which I brought you in source number 11 from the Shulchan Aruch, which says that you could be yotzei shalashuddas with fruit. So could they say, I'm going to use fruit for shalashuddas, even though ordinarily that's not the way it's supposed to be done. It's supposed to be bread or mizonos or something like that. But in this case, that way you avoid having to test blood sugar, having to avoid, and you avoid taking insulin. So that, hang on, I want to make sure you hear it. That was Rishachter's answer. Rishachter's answer was they should use the free food fruits, even though it's not as great as a shalashuddas food, in order to avoid having to do the testing and the insulin. Yes, Ricky.
My family's kabbalah, and we don't eat shalashuddas for me either. It's like a kabbalah.
You don't eat
shalashuddas.
You don't eat shalashuddas at all?
No, we eat fruit.
Oh, you eat fruit. Okay.
It's like a kabbalah thing.
That's very interesting. I did not know that. Okay, interesting. All right. Aren't you hungry? Okay.
We have fruit.
Yeah.
Isn't bread not a dough rice for shalashuddas? Like,
I'm not talking to orisas.
Saying like, at that point, it just becomes preference then, or like, what's better than?
Yeah, but it's a fairly serious thing. Whether it's a del rice or not is another story. But it's a fairly serious thing that one who can really should, or at least use mizonos. Yeah, so that's like, the. You see the hierarchy in source number 11, right from the Shulchan Aruch. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is send out the link for the quiz. It's a 5 out of 7.